This morning, the prosecutors are laying out how they believe Alex Cox did it. Is there going to be enough evidence to convict Lori Vallow? The Letitia Stout trial continues, but we're getting close to an end. A horrific case developing in Louisiana. A judge gone wild. And if you can't trust your DoorDash driver, who can you trust? And then finally, our dumb criminal of the day. Let's talk about it. Good day, everyone. My name is Scott Reich, and this is Crime Talk. Thanks for joining us. Can you believe it is already May 1st of 2023? Unbelievable. All right, you know the drill. Subscribe if you haven't, like if you do, leave me a comment below, and hit that little bell so that you receive notifications of when we go live or put up new content. And remember, you can listen to us anytime on any of your favorite podcasting apps. And I must note, thank you all for doing that. We've had more downloads last month than we've ever had before. So thank you. All right. Also, we need to pay the bills. So go to crimetalksearch.com, sign up for that background subscription service today. When you do sign up, you can do as many background searches as you desire. And remember, you can cancel at any time. But literally, when you search for an individual, you're asked a series of questions. They narrow down the individual that you are searching. And guess what? You get a report literally prepared and emailed to you within minutes. It's going to have information as to how these people are employed. Oh, those social media accounts. Huh. I think that's probably the most surprising thing when you do these searches is, why does somebody have so many email accounts? Well, usually because they're associated with other websites. You know, those dating ones that they don't tell everybody about. Yeah, check it out. Go to crimetalksearch.com and find out. I'm telling you, there's always something in there that surprises you. All right, let's go ahead and open the record and let's begin the docket for May 1st of 2023. Well, the Lori Vallow trial resumed this week, and prosecuting attorney Rob Wood called the next witness to the stand. The witness is Kelly Coleman, and she is a senior DNA analyst at Bode Technology in Virginia. Now, Bode Technology is a private DNA lab that does a lot of testing. Usually their technology is state-of-the-art and then some. Way back in the day, they used to only test for like 7. Bode could do like 13. Now I think we're up to 20-something different alleles to determine DNA. Anyway, she explained what DNA is. It's the biological material that makes up each person's and makes them unique, and is found in almost every cell of the body. And you get half of the DNA from your mom and half from your dad. 99% of the DNA is the same among individuals, but that little 1% is unique among individuals, and that's the DNA that the lab is looking at, and that controls how they use it in DNA testing. Now, the technician then went on and said that there are two controls that she used, a positive control, which is a known DNA sample, and a negative control is all of the chemicals that they use in the biological procedure, but they have no DNA added to them. And now Ms. Coleman then describes that a DNA profile is what a partial DNA profile is. And then she says that Bode Technology received information from the Rexburg Police Department in regards to the Lori Vallow case for testing. And then back in May of 2022, she received 3 DNA profiles. So they've already received, they've done the swab, saying here's the profile for Lori Vallow, Tylee Ryan, and Melanie Gibb. She also received several items of evidence, including a hair that was attached to an adhesive. That's right, piece of tape. Lori's hair was stuck on a piece of duct tape with JJ's body. And they tested against those 3 known profiles, Tylee, Melanie, and Lori. Now, Ms. Coleman says a portion of the hair was put into a test tube and it went through a series of washes to get rid of any extraneous DNA on the hair. And they were trying to focus on that hair. Well, they added some additional chemicals to the sample, and then it went through heat and cooling samples, and then they were also able to determine how much DNA was in the sample, and then made lots and lots of copies. That's how they do it. They take the sample, and then they copy that profile in the DNA. Anyway, the partial DNA profile matched the DNA profile from, guess who? Lori Vallow. the probability of randomly selecting a random individual in relation to that profile is 1 in 71 billion. So I think we're pretty confident that the hair belonged to Lori Vallow. Now, you would expect that on cross-examination, the defense would say, now, you can't really say how that hair got there. Was that just on, you know, a piece of clothing there on old JJ? You can't say if they were cuddling earlier in the night and a hair from Lori's head came off, or was it involved, was that hair placed there when the homicide took place? No. What did the defense do? They said, hey, there's a chart and it shows 22 different DNA alleles tested on the hair. And Ms. Coleman says, well, yes, this out of the 22, 13 had no results. And of course, the defense says, well, 13 of 22, that's a lot, right? And the expert says an allele is one of two of the more versions of a DNA sequence, a single base or a segment of bases at any given genome location. And on redirect, you know, the prosecution says, hey, 1 in 71 billion, that's a pretty big number. What exactly does that mean statistically? And that's where the technician, Ms. Coleman, says, that means if I was able to stick my hand into a hat of DNA profiles, I would expect to see this profile 1 in 71 billion times. So, like I said, I'm surprised the defense didn't get into questions about, you can't really say how that hair got there, when that hair got there. Now, we're getting summaries, but definitely going to have to listen to the audio that we will put up later this evening, because there's going to be more good stuff. And now the good stuff, okay? Let me explain. How many times have we said on the show that the development of the cellular telephone has become the greatest crime-fighting tool ever invented? Because everyone takes their cell phone with them everywhere they go. And it follows you and gives, you know, usually within plus or minus of about 5 feet exactly where you go. And that's what they did in the Lori Vallow case, particularly thus far, what we've heard as it relates to Alex Cox. So, a witness by the name of Rick White was called. Now, he is a contract special investigator for the FBI. So it's like he retired, they need agents, they're short, they bring him back to do some work. Well, and that's exactly what happened. He was a special agent for 24 years before becoming the contract special investigator. Mr. Wright began investigating the J.J. Vallow disappearance on November 27th of 2019. This was shortly after being contacted by the Rexburg police and under the Federal Kidnapping Act, and the FBI was able to get involved because the missing child was initially under 12. Now, the police were only aware that J.J. was missing when he was contacted, and then the FBI began an investigation, and Wright was the case manager. And he stated that fairly early on, we determined that JJ's sibling, Tylee Ryan, could also not be located. And then Mr. Wright details two police departments in Arizona, the Fremont County Sheriff's Office and the Rexburg Police Department, were all involved in this investigation. Fremont was probing the death of Tammy Daybell, and Chandler police were looking into the death of Charles Vallow. Now, the Gilbert Police Department were looking into the shooting of Brandon Boudreau, and they prosecutor asked Mr. Wright if he met with Ian Pawlowski, and he said that he had spoken with Ian at the Rexburg Police Department back in December 5th of 2019. Now, after that conversation, Wright says his concerns for the children's safety increased hugely. He was asked to consensually record conversations when he was a party to. Now, Mr. Wright says Ian agreed to and recorded some conversations he had with Melanie, his wife, and Lori, and Alex, and Chad. Now, the recording device belonged to the Rexburg Police Department, and they have copies of these conversations. Yes, at that point, they are an agent for the government. Well, Mr. Wright goes on, and he goes through some slides that he was allowed to put together. Apparently, he worked last night to make this a little more easy for the jury to understand. So, he first starts out by saying that Alex Cox began residing in Idaho about September 1st based upon his cell phone data. Alex moved from St. George, Utah to Rexburg the evening of the 1st, and then his cell phone device began spending its evenings at the Pioneer Road apartment. Now, beginning September 5th, the device began to go to another unit in the complex, and then they put up a slide, apparently, that showed that the Alex phone activity shows data points based upon the cell phone as he went to and from Yellowstone on Sunday, September 8th of 2019. So according to the former special agent, the contract agent, Mr. Wright, that the data points come from the GPS, Wi-Fi, and cell phone tower data. How many times have we talked about that? I'm telling you, not that I'm telling people to commit crimes, but if you're going to, don't take your phone, okay? Now, this information was all compiled together with each data point, and they looked at it individually. Mr. Wright says that Alex's device left at Rexburg at 11:32 a.m. on September 8th. He then describes how they begin to see data trail as it goes to the West Yellowstone entrance. And then the device goes to Old Faithful, then further into the park, and eventually leaves the park at about 6:40 p.m. There were stops at Old Faithful and the nearby cafeteria around 3 p.m., according to Mr. Wright. And that's when some photos were taken on the boardwalk at Old Faithful about 3:49. Those were the photos that were recovered from Lori Vallow's iCloud account. Now, these were the last known images of Tylee's being alive. Now, the agent then goes on, Mr. Wright goes on and explains how Alex's device moved throughout the park as a map is displayed, describing his testimony. He says that the data points were frequent, and Mr. Wright tried to identify potential areas of investigation. He says that Alex's vehicle did not stop for any long period of time until it went to the West Yellowstone entrance exit after it left the park. Now, Wright says there didn't seem to be any unusual stopping or deviation while in the park. There was a stop at a barbecue restaurant in West Yellowstone. Now, the vehicle arrived back at Lori's apartment back in Rexburg at 8:37 p.m., according to the identifying data. And they could not identify much of anything to investigate with the Yellowstone trip. Everything seemed, as he described, pretty normal, and he was confident Tylee returned to the apartment. Now, after Alex's device returns to Loria's apartment, it goes to a Maverick gas station for 10 minutes around 9:43 p.m. It then goes back to Lori's apartment from and then to Alex's apartment. There are several data points on Alex's device in Lori's apartment on September 9th from 2:42 a.m. until 8:49 a.m. Now, Wright says he observed all the activity on Alex's device for the month of September. And he says that Alex was often in Lori's apartment from around 8 to midnight, and then the device would go into Alex's apartment. It would stay there until morning or sometimes as late as noon. This was the only time that he observed it to go to the apartment between midnight and 6 a.m. Now, Mr. Wright points out the distance between Alex and Lori's apartments was about 80 meters. Now, other data points were recorded on Alex's phone at 4:37, 4:39, 4:41, 5:14, 6:47 a.m., and 8:49 a.m. And then on Monday, September 9th, the devices depart Alex's apartment at 9 a.m. It travels north to Chad Daybell's house, 8 miles north of the apartment, and arrives at approximately 9:15 a.m. There were data points that were recorded between 9:15 and 9:45 on Chad Daybell's property. By 11:45 a.m., the device is traveling southbound and returns to Rexburg. At 11:52, it stops at a Del Taco for roughly 10 minutes. Now, Mr. Wright observed 4 major data points during the time Alex was at the Daybell property. A data point appears at the shed at approximately 9:21 a.m., and a 6-meter radius margin of error. At 9:22 a.m., there's a data point at a gate into the property. Now, you can apparently get into the property from this gate. When we were there, we showed video of the aerial. I think you can see the property where you could get in to from the road there. And Mr. Wright described how they weren't able to receive any further data points until 10:57 a.m. Then we have the raccoon text. As you may recall, Chad sent a text to Tammy, his wife, on Monday, September 9th at approximately 11:53, telling her he had to burn some limbs and debris when he was saw this raccoon and had to kill and bury it in the pet cemetery. Now, the text and data points by the fire pit, they're certainly set up some red flags to the FBI when they were doing the investigation. The Rexburg Police Department obtained a warrant to search that property, Mr. Wright says, and that's ultimately where they found the human remains of Tylee, where they were found buried near the data points, the remains of Tylee and Ryan. I'm telling you, ladies and gentlemen, greatest crime-fighting tool ever invented, the cell phone. Mr. Wright then describes the activity from Alex's device on September 22nd, the last time that JJ was seen alive. There was some traffic with the device, he describes, and Alex went back and forth between Lori's apartment and his apartment at 4:29 p.m. and 12:11 a.m. Alex's device doesn't move from his apartment between 12:11 a.m. and 9:41 a.m. on September 23rd. And at 9:41 a.m., the device travels from the apartment to Chad Daybell's home, where it arrives at approximately 9:55 a.m. By 10:12 a.m., Alex's device departs the residence southbound until Rexburg and goes back to Lori's apartment until 10:22 a.m., where he remains until 11:14 a.m. in the morning. Now, data points were found near the pond on Chad's property between 9:55 and 10:02 a.m. JJ's remains were ultimately found by the pond, and Tylee's were found buried by the fire pit. Mr. Wright says that the phone was at or near Daybell's residence four times in September of 2019, on September 6th, September 9th, September 23rd, and September 25th. Now, Alex Cox also visited Dan's window tinting in Rexburg on September 23rd for about 5 minutes. He visited the store twice on September 25th. Yes, and apparently an image was put up of the Jeep used in Brandon Boudreau's Arizona shooting. And guess what? The Jeep had tinted windows. Police searched the vehicle after it was seized, and two receipts were found inside. One was from a Mexican restaurant on October 1st of 2019 at 1:12 p.m. The shooting of Brandon took place on October 2nd. The other receipts from Chick-fil-A in Amon on October 18th, 2019 at 8:05. Now remember, Tammy Daybell died the night of October 18th and into the early morning hours of October 19th. The receipt date was significant to law enforcement because on September 25th, Alex visited Walmart in Idaho Falls and bought a cell phone with cash at approximately 7:10 p.m. Mr. Wright says that his other cell phone shows that he was near the Walmart on that same date. On October 8th, Alex visited the Walmart in Rexburg between 3:01 and 3:37. Now, after Alex and Lori abandoned their Rexburg apartments, the property managers found two cell phones in Alex's unit. The phones were turned over to the police, and Wright learned the phones were the ones purchased at the Walmart stores. Now, on September 30th, Alex's device is at Lori's apartment on October 1st and 2nd. It stays in Alex's apartment the entire time. And then, on October 3rd, Alex's device is back in Lori's apartment for the first time since September 30th. Data points from all this information obtained from phones and the search warrants from Alex's phone were recorded at the Unified Sportsman's Gun Club in Rexburg on September 3rd. Then it went to Walmart and back to the club. There was another visit to the gun range on September 26th and the 27th, and the device was also at the same gun range on September 28th for about 2.5 hours. On October 7th, Alex visited multiple gun ranges according to the data points. He also went to two gun ranges on October 8th. Like I said, remember, Tammy Daybell was shot at in her driveway on October 9th. Alex also visited a gun range on October 12th, where he spent time at the 50-yard range. He returned on October 13th and spent time at the rifle and pistol ranges. On October 15th, Alex went to a shooting range twice. Between visits, he went to his apartment, Lori's apartment, Walmart, and then returning to Chad Daybell's house as well. Now, former Special Agent Wright, now Contract Agent Wright, says he was looking at gun range data because of the gunman incident involving Tammy Daybell, the attempted shooting of Brandon, and the fact that a lot of guns and ammunition were found inside Lori's garage. Now, on October 9th, there was a series of data points associated to Alex's phone at the Sportsman's Warehouse in Amon. Wright points out on the map where the data points were recorded inside the store. Wright went into the Sportsman's Warehouse and pulled all the receipts during that time period for Alex Cox when he was there. On a particular receipt that caught his attention, there were around 60 receipts, and most were paid with credit or debit cards. The one that caught his attention was a cash receipt. Five items were on the receipt, including a pair of Frog Tog rain pants. The property manager at Alex's apartment had a pair of Frog Tog pants in their possession. The receipt also had a ski mask, a soft drinks, and gloves. He learned a camo beanie listed on the receipt was no longer in stock, but all the other items were. And then he showed photos of items that were similar, but not the exact ones that Alex Cox had purchased. Now, the glove has a mitten portion that you can pull over your finger and you can keep off. You can use your finger in the mitten portion if it isn't folded over. We've all seen those kinds of mittens where you can pull them over and you can pull it and you still use your fingers and put it back on top. Okay. So there are also a number of searches that were conducted of the Homer J. Maximus account on October 9th of 2019. One was for the Frog Tog sizing for pants. And October 9th, Alex's device left the Sportsman's Warehouse at 4:12 p.m. and traveled north to Chad's house. It didn't stop, but drives by and continues onto Highway 20. The driver then turns around and drives past the Daybell residence again before returning to Alex's apartment at 5:16 p.m. The device remains in his apartment until 11:28 a.m. the following day. Now, they put up a big map, and it shows on the screen, it shows Wright was pointing out the spots where the data points were recorded by Alex's phone the evening of October 9th. A data point is recorded at a canal behind Chad Daybell's house. The road is fairly narrow, and there is a small shoulder there. But here it is. Boom! That's right. The cell phone Alex bought at Walmart, he bought one on October 8th, but was not activated until October 9th at 1:20 p.m. 10 messages were sent from that phone to a device to Chad Daybell between 7:13 p.m. and 10:30 p.m., while Alex's other phone was recorded at and staying at the apartment the entire night. Like I said, the new phone was texting, guess who? Chad Daybell. Is that a conspiracy, ladies and gentlemen, or just coincidence? Was Alex Cox acting alone, or was he in a conspiracy with Lori Vallow and Chad Daybell to kill J.J. Tylee and Tammy Daybell? I guess we're going to have to listen in tonight to the actual recording to see what evidence comes about. Now, remember, there's been a lot of superficial kind of peripheral stuff, but no real smoking gun as of just yet. Finally, getting something a little new. Now, everybody knows, we've been saying all along, Alex Cox was going to be the prime suspect, and the defense is going to play him off as a rogue individual acting on his own. There was no contract. There's no text messages, at least as of right now. We're just going to have to wait and see. Next on the docket, Letitia Stauch. Yes, in video played late Friday, Letitia Stauch told evaluators, mental health evaluators, about shooting Gannon, but thinking that a man in a black cape broke into their home. She suggested that they mistook the person because of the way the cover was wrapped around this particular individual, not Gannon. And she said, never in a million years would she purposely ever hurt her stepson, and asserted that she wouldn't be in this country if she meant to do it. And she was quite perplexed that they want to paint me out as this monster. And I did all these crazy things. I never once knew it was Gannon, she said. In fact, didn't even know it was Gannon until later. Just another story from Letitia Stauch, ladies and gentlemen. Now, the prosecution is getting close to ending the case. Could be later today or early tomorrow. Good prosecutor's going to drag this out, make sure they haven't forgotten everything, go back, check all their little checklists to make sure they got everything done, and probably rest sometime tomorrow. But we've been bringing you this trial, and guess what? Probably the only defense witness is going to be the doctor, the psychiatrist that says that Letitia Stauch has been or is a victim of or is diagnosed with this dissociative disorder that all the other evaluators completely rejected. So we're going to have to wait and see. Next, this is absolutely horrific. So police in Louisiana found Bella Fontelle, okay? She's 6 years old. Where was she found? Inside the drum outside her mother, Jennifer Zeldin's home on Wednesday. This was just hours after the girl's father reported her and his girlfriend missing. So the Jefferson Parish officials now believe that Hannah Landon, the longtime girlfriend of the girl's father, Michael, killed Bella at the home she shared with him nearby. Now, it's alleged that Landon stuffed the body into a 10-gallon chlorine bucket and covered the lid, which she then put on a little kid's pull wagon, right? You know, kind of pulled little kids along, and pulled over a block away to the Zeldin home Tuesday night. The police were able to find surveillance footage from that night that shows a woman with a plastic bucket in the direction of the house. The woman in the clip was wearing tall white boots, a red top, and black pants. Now, Landon, who also goes by Boonock Lim and Boonock Landon, has since been arrested on charges of first-degree murder and obstruction of justice as it relates to Bella's death and is being held without bail. Authorities say that Bella's father reported his girlfriend and youngest daughter missing at around 7:30 a.m. on April 26, sparking a missing persons investigation. At some point during the search, Herrera's police decided to search Jennifer's property less than two blocks away, where they found the bucket with the body inside. At some point during the search, police decided to search Jennifer's property. It was only a couple blocks away. What did they find? Yeah, the bucket with the body inside. Now, an autopsy was conducted, and it was determined that Bella, a kindergartner at the St. Matthew Apostle Catholic School in River Ridge, had been murdered with multiple injuries. The coroner said the cause of death was manual strangulation with blunt force trauma to the head. Sheriff Deputy spoke with neighbors and friends and eventually discovered a Ring camera that caught the woman dragging the plastic bucket on top of it about 9:35 p.m. Tuesday night. Now, it's alleged that after she dumped the body, authorities say that Landon then entered a police station asking for transport to a local hospital. She was then located and arrested at the hospital the following day. Now, a motive for the murder remains unclear at this time, but police records and divorce papers show that Landon and Bella's mother had been in physical altercations in the past. In 2021, the two women fought physically at a swim meet for one of the daughters, and the father had to intervene to stop it. Authorities say that they do not believe that Bella's mother or father were involved in her death in any way. If that doesn't destroy your faith in humanity, I don't know what will. But how about something on a little bit of a lighter side? You know, let's talk judges gone wild. Well, here locally, the Colorado Supreme Court censured a former district court judge over in Mesa County. Now, the former judge is a guy by the name of Lance Timbreza. Well, he stepped down last fall. Now, the public report was concluded that he made improper advances toward a younger male attorney while both attended a Colorado Bar Association conference last June. Now, what have I said about conferences, ladies and gentlemen? That's right. People attend these to do what they can't do at home. Don't get me wrong. Yes, there's some good information, but a lot of people go to get away and to party. Just saying. Anyway, the Supreme Court panel has ordered him to pay over $20,000 in attorney's fees and costs, and the Supreme Court tribunal also wrote that Timbreza became intoxicated and made sexual advances to this younger attorney. His name has not been released, understandably, But the opinion says that the attorney didn't welcome the advances but didn't physically stop Timbreza or tell him no. So the report concludes that Timbreza spent the night in the attorney's hotel room but claims that he fell asleep. The tribunal reports the attorney didn't detail what happened in the room, but let's just say there were some disputed facts. Now, Timbreza, trying to maintain, obviously, the standards of a judge, no, failed miserably. Why? He was already censured previously for a drunk driving incident. That's right. If you're going to be a judge, you have to be do it better and cleaner than everybody else. Because how can you sentence people when you can't obey the own laws? It's somewhat hypocritical. I get it. We're all hypocrites. It's just a matter of degree. But if you're going to sit in judgment of others like that, you better have a pretty clear record of yourself. Just saying. So as I noted, if the topics we've covered so far hasn't destroyed your faith in humanity, maybe this one will. If you can't trust your food delivery driver, who can you trust? Now, sometimes I order in lunch here, okay, every day. And sometimes, even though they deliver it every day, they take it to the back door of the building. I don't get it. Anyway, take a look. The driver here was seen arriving at the delivery address in a sedan before getting out, and he taking out pizza boxes from the car's passenger side. Take a look. After walking the food to the front door and placing it on the steps, the man takes his few steps back, captures a photo of the food to show that he, in fact, delivered it, and then he grabs the food and puts it back in the car before driving off. Now, it's bad enough when the delivery driver steals your food, but the reason you ordered the food was because the business owner, well, guess what? They was trying to boost the spirits of his employees. They were a little demoralized because his business had been broken into and completely ransacked, causing roughly $70,000 in damage. Now, the business owner didn't want to say who they are, given their vulnerabilities that they have. And they said that DoorDash provided new food and said they anyone caught stealing would be deactivated from their platform. But it just shows you, ladies and gentlemen, one, I guess when it rains, it pours, you get your business ransacked, and then they just steal your food. Now, I'm not saying it's a California thing, San Francisco thing, I don't know, but what can you do?
As a pet owner, you want to give your furry friend the very best. That's why Baked in Colorado's CBD-infused dog treats are the perfect choice. These delicious treats not only taste great, but they also provide a wide range of health benefits for your pet. CBD has been shown to have many positive effects on dogs, including reducing anxiety, alleviating pain and inflammation, and improving overall wellness. Baked in Colorado's treats are infused with premium full-spectrum CBD oil, meaning your pet will benefit from the whole plant extract. Not only that, but Baked in Colorado's treats are made with all-natural human-grade ingredients, so you can feel good about what you're giving your pet. They're also free from wheat, corn, and soy, making them a great option for dogs with food sensitivities. Baked in Colorado CBD-infused dog treats are the perfect way to support your pet's health and well-being. With various flavors, including peanut butter, pumpkin, and bacon, your dog will love them too. So why wait? Head to www.bakedincolorado.com today and order your dog a bag of these delicious and nutritious treats. Your pet will thank you for it.
All right, how about a little lighter note? How about our dumb criminal of the day? So the South Carolina man was apparently divorced, but he was living with his ex-wife, but he was arrested the other morning after he cocked a firearm and tried to ruin the mood because his ex-wife and her new boyfriend were apparently getting quite loud when they were engaging in sexual acts. The police reports allege that Alan Riggs began banging on the walls of the Myrtle Beach duplex where his ex, Jolene Wolfrey, and her new boyfriend were having sex. Riggs and Wolfrey are both 24, like I said, ex-spouses, but they've lived together for the last 2 years. I think it's time to move on. Well, anyway, in addition to hearing Riggs banging on the walls, the victim and her boyfriend then heard the racking sound of a firearm, which got their attention, and apparently they stopped making loud, passionate love. Well, Ms. Rolfrey said that when she later went downstairs, Mr. Riggs had a gun in his hand and then also threatened her life. When questioned by the Myrtle Beach Police Department, Mr. Riggs said that he became upset when he heard the couple having sex and banged on their walls to try to get them to quit. But after that didn't work, yes, he did go to his car and get his gun. Mr. Riggs then confessed that he, when he returned to the home and, in fact, did cock his firearm in what he said was an attempt to ruin the mood. Apparently it worked, because after the activity upstairs stopped, Riggs returned to the couch only to play his video games. And the police confiscated the pistol from Mr. Riggs, booked into evidence, and he was arrested and booked into the jail as well. And now, because you wanted to live with your ex-wife, I think you got some issues, you got to move on. Yeah, he's now in jail for a $100,000 bond. You can't go around threatening people with firearms. Mr. Riggs, that's just dumb. Living with your ex-wife is dumb, okay? When you get divorced, there's a reason for it. You don't want to see him anymore for this very exact reason. Just saying. All right, that's all we have for today. Make sure you watch the Letitia Stauch. It's getting good. And we will put up the audio from the Lori Vallow trial as soon as we get it this evening. Have a wonderful day, and we'll see you next time on Crime Talk.